I'm Matt Pittler, host of the Business of Biotech podcast. And if you're listening to my voice right now, but not seeing my face, maybe you haven't heard that we've launched a new Business of Biotech videocast page under the Listen and Watch tab at bioprocessonline.com. There, you'll find hundreds of videos of my interviews with biotech builders, categorized by topic like finance and capital markets, regulatory, discovery, and manufacturing. Don't try it if you listen while driving. But be sure to check it out when you get where you're going. Go to bioprocessonline.com, hit the Listen and Watch tab, and choose Business of Biotech in the dropdown.
I'm not shy about my admiration for the flagship pioneering community. It's a veritable breeding ground for biotech innovation, and the organization has given us generous access to its partner CEOs, itself a who's who of biotech entrepreneurship. Less than a year into his role as CEO at Ampersand Biomedicines, Jason Gardner offers a case in point. He joined Ampersand on the heels of his leadership of the rise and ultimate wind down of Magenta Therapeutics, that tenure preceded by a lengthy career that started at Chiron and saw a long stay at GSK. Jason's seen some things, experienced the highs and the lows, and come back for more, demonstrating the kind of fortitude required of a leader in this tough business. At Ampersand, he's working on a tech-driven platform that aims to redefine how we identify local precision medicine targets and develop navigable therapeutics to address those targets. I'm Matt Pittler. This is the Business of Biotech, and I was honored to sit down with Jason in San Francisco to discuss this heady stuff and a whole lot more. Let's give it a listen.
Jason Gardner, CEO at Ampersand. Before we get into learning about Ampersand, I want to rewind a little bit and get to know you. It's always interesting to me when an exec leaves the at least perceived comforts of a company like GSK, where you were for 11 years, to jump into sort of a biotech. You did that, notably leading Magenta Therapeutics after 11 years at GSK. So the fundamental question is what motivated you to make that move?
Yes. So first of all, Matt, thanks for having me.
No, my pleasure.
Great to be here. So reflecting back at that time and that decision, there were really three memories behind that. So first, the science.
Mm-hmm.
The science of our medicine was really coming together with a number of academic labs and new programs coming out. It was a great opportunity to potentially build a company around them. Second was the impact of patients. So transplants are curative. Transplants are really not done as widely as they could be because it's quite hard for patients to go through it. And initial transplants what we generally built to solve with this new science. And the third was the team, the people. So one of the people who's co-founded with me was my former postdoc at Harvard, David Scadden. And then both Atlas Ventures and Third Rock Ventures were interested in the science in building separate companies. And so we were able to bring them together and build one company, and that became Magenta Therapeutics. So that combination, and we'll talk a bit more about that in terms of future decision-making, science, the impact on patients and the people, to me, it was very important. And so even though I wasn't looking to leave GSK, that was the only three motivation.
There's got to be, and I ask this question often, and sometimes I get honest, there's got to be, you know, at least some degree of trepidation when you make a move like that. I mean, people spend their entire careers at companies like GSK comfortably, especially in leadership positions like you were in. I mean, you know, it wasn't like there was the end of a career trajectory there.
Right.
So walk me through that. Like speaking to folks who may be considering making such a move, how do you rationalize it? And how did your wife take it, Jason?
So I've been in biotech before GSK. I spent 8 years first here at Chiron as a junior scientist and then at Regenetics.
Okay.
In New York as a more senior scientist. So I knew a bit about biotech and life in a smaller company. And again, I'd be very happy and had great opportunities at GSK. But this was a moment for me to really look at those three principles, the science, the impact on patients, and the team. And I just felt doing that in a new company startup environment would be impactful and also a challenge to me personally in the next chapter of my career. So that dinner table conversation with my wife was very interesting, and I got very clear feedback that if this was the moment, this is what I should do.
Yeah. The support is fundamental.
And you're incredibly, can I just double click on that? So when I was building Magenta, and then similarly now at Apis, and I talk about that, we got employees. Our employees' families and their friends and their networks are really part of our extended team. And then we rely on them sometimes, you know, when the days are long and there are ups and downs and twists and turns in our industry and in our work. It's often our families and our friends who provide that support. So I always thank our team members to ensure that they pass on that thanks to that team, that extended team. That's very important.
Yeah. Another transition that I wanted to get your perspective on would be, I mean, you mentioned that you started out as you were a research scientist.
Yes.
Yeah. At what point along the road did you begin to develop an interest in leadership and business development? And
yeah, so basically, I went into biotech and into the industry principally because I loved science, but I really wanted to make medicines. And then I just thought that was the best way to do that. And so learning the science and the industry, which is really the foundation of our industry, was terrific. And then worked on programs that became medicines. So I'm very fortunate that I worked with great teams. And then naturally, I was fortunate to get leadership opportunities, leading projects first, and then leading teams, and then building teams, and then building units over the years. And then the business side just came alongside that, you know, setting up budgets, setting up partnerships, knowing how to do that, learning, adapting, and thinking strategically. And so I learned a lot of the business from people who I worked with from by doing and delivering. And I think that's a very important way. You can learn a lot in school and a lot both on the science and the business side, but doing that in practice and doing that with great people who you can learn from and being humble. Being humble and also knowing that everything we do here in the industry is as a team. Being able to communicate well and listen and learn fast I've been very lucky to have those opportunities, and I'm excited about what we're doing now. Flagship and Anderson.
Yeah, very good. Was there a particular point where, as you assume those responsibilities, those leadership responsibilities, was there a particular point where, a light bulb moment? Like, I want to run the show.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. I believe in, my values were mainly around impacting patients. And if I was using science to do that in a leadership role, that was in battle. And then for me, if I could make more, I never woke up one day and thought, I have to be a CEO. I want to be a CEO. It was more of a natural just a progression. And for me, I was also very fortunate to have a number of influential mentors and still do in my career, both at GSK, both beyond GSK and until today. In the venture world, in the biotech world. And I believe firmly that those types of experienced mentors, those folks who have been CEOs or been leaders, provide a huge amount of feedback into our system. Even though they're not kind of in those operational roles.
Yeah.
That's incredibly important. You look at the diaspora, certainly in the Boston biotech community, of companies that have become great companies, and team members have gone on to do great things in other companies and then beyond. It's an amazing network.
Yeah.
And it's one of the reasons I believe the venture firms, the investors like Flagship have, talent base, the networks to be able to access and tap into that. And so as a CEO, I remember one of my mentors, right? This took the role, as we created and co-founded Magenta, told me the CEO is the loneliest job in the world. It is the time where you find out how you can make hard decisions. but it doesn't need to be. You have often experienced board, a team around you, and then system, those networks can be very helpful.
Yeah. Did you take advantage of any like formalized network opportunities? Like, or was it more of an informal?
Oh, no, it's more informal. And I would say, I think folks have been very generous with their time, which with me over the years. And I also like to sort of network with people as well and share experiences.
Yeah.
And in today's flagship world as well, there is a very vibrant cross CEO and cross company and within the flagship ecosystem.
Right.
A lot of sharing of experiences and ideas as well. It's a great model. We'll talk more about it for company creation. It's also a great model and network for company building and company execution as well, that interplay.
Sure.
Between those experiences. So I think networking and the networking skills, and I tell my children who are teenagers about that, and what you learn in college is going to be important. What you then do with that is going to be important in your careers. But who and how you work and building those networks over the years is going to be important for whatever career choice I've made, for example, particularly in bias.
Entirely. I mean, I could go long on stories about this. My son just started college this past fall. And he's of this mindset where he just thinks he has to have everything mapped out. And I'm like, but you can map it out all you want. It's not going to play out the way you, but yes. it's who, what, and yes. And how, right? You
yes.
interact. So I want to get the story behind your arrival on the scene at Flagship. So you're only 6 or so months on the scene right now?
Five.
Okay.
Yep.
So not even 6 yet. Yeah. Yep. So new there, you joined Flagship sort of on the heels of Magenta's wind down.
Yes,
that'd be the appropriate way to put it. So how did that come to pass?
Yeah, so basically I was thinking about my next role and the way I could impact patients and science and really bring my experience to an organization. So I got to know the Flagship team. I've used several members there already. So Paul Biondi, who runs medicines, Rita Bassi as well, various other folks. And we started a conversation about, what could be an interesting opportunity. So we get to dive in on. Then I got to know a back convention and the Ampersand team. And I went on the CDA. I read the website and I listened to a lot of the Flagship interviews on YouTube as well. So I really got to understand about what it's like to work there, doing diligence as folks to people. But I went on the CDA and I played and saw the Ampersand data, the science, and I was blown away. And I thought, this is what I have to do next. I'm going to talk a bit about what the company's doing, the platform. But I really wanted to build a platform company, just a business optionality. I think the opportunities to partnerships, we'll talk about that. In this current capital markets, it's very powerful. I like the impact of this platform on how patients, the architecture, and then the team. So the team was terrific, and the Flagship model and the expertise that Flagship brings. So it checked those three boxes for me. And so it was a very, in the end, straightforward decision. I'm about to say the dinner table conversation this time. I have it with my wife. It was very straightforward.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah, Ampersand formed up officially in 21.
Yes.
So obviously it was before your arrival on the scene, but give me a little bit of the backstory into how and why.
Yeah, so this is really, I think, very important about the Flagship model. So the science comes from Flagship explorations into emerging areas of breaking science. So 3 years ago, if you wind the clock back, was really when big biology, big data, AI was starting to emerge onto the biotech scene. So Flagship creates companies around audacious questions, right? Questions that other investors would look at and ask why would you ask that question,
right?
And so, that can be incredibly powerful thinking about what could happen next. And the question for Ampersand basically was, what if we could program smarter medicines to act and work only where they're needed in the body, right? So this is a question that has challenged the industry since the start. We make many medicines that work, and we give them to patients. The vast majority of them do not specifically target exactly where they need to be. So I'll give you an example. Steroids. Steroids are used widely. There's a neutral inflammation. Steroids work. Steroids work across lots of tissues. It causes lots of side effects. And we wish we could just target them specifically to where they're needed, right? So there's lots of other types of medicines that could also apply that to. So with that question, how do you do that? Well, with big data and AI starting to emerge 3 years ago, basically they built the company around this challenge of creating an addressed map, molecular anatomy of the human body, tissue, cellular, and protein level. Mm-hmm. Understanding all the potential targets that you could then use to send medicines exactly to where they needed. It programmed biologics. So basically, take an address, and say it's in the kidney, and then make an antibody just to bind to that address, and then attach the antibody to an active drug that you then send to the kidney, and it only works in the kidney.
Yeah.
You already know the drug's active, maybe an approved drug, right? But it could be a drug that's already been there suddenly, but it didn't work out because it didn't have the right potency levels or it had safety effects. But you can then apply this address map across very different tissues and diseases, right, as a platform. So that was 3 years ago. In the first year, started to assemble all these publicly available data sets, start the algorithms to predict the targets. And then over the next 2 years, developed even bigger data sets, both public as well as proprietary data sets, but within the flagship ecosystem. And then started to generate data because the algorithms and the machine learning can actually design the molecules on the computer,
yeah,
such that you can then test them on the computer in the machine learning,
right?
And then you can test a handful in the lab, and you can do that within months,
yeah,
which would normally take years, and frankly, would still have a high risk of whether the biology would work. So, and I'll just take a step back. Today, at the start of clinical development, 90% of the drugs start clinical development will fail.
Right.
So imagine if you're a sports player, right? And you're at 90% or 10% batting average as a baseball player, right? It just wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the reasons that that number is so high, the failure rate, is because our ability to select good targets and send drugs to the right places, the biodistribution of our medicines, has never been possible to make it precise or program without this type of platform. So that was the foundational science in this platform, the address map, machine learning, the algorithms, the ability to get started to drugs within months, not years. And then I started to look at the data and the early projects and talk about some of them. It was really exciting. And so I knew this would be a big story.
Yeah.
The vision. And a vision that you could actually show and understand that it was working very quickly, even in preclinical studies.
Mm-hmm.
The opportunities across broad sets of diseases, the opportunities for partnerships, and I think the opportunities to make a massive impact that would not have been possible before.
Yeah. When you started talking about sort of the idea and you said the investment community, the traditional investment community might, look at that wide-eyed, right? Raise an eyebrow, perhaps. Flagship strikes me as interesting in its commitment to the exploratory.
Yeah.
I don't know, there's probably a more eloquent way of saying that, but it's unique. And I wonder how it's rationalized. Like, what's your perception on that? How do you rationalize funding, especially in this economy, when there are so many VCs are tranching deals based on outcomes, specific milestones, like, and if it doesn't happen, it's over. Like you're talking about putting significant resources behind big concepts, I'm just curious. I'm like, how would you actualize that?
So it's a great question. And from my perspective, it really is best answered in through the lens of the platform. Do you really believe you have a platform and you're building a platform company? Or are you really interested in building an asset in a company with one or two assets? So in order to have a platform, right, you have to, I believe, as a business, you have to set out milestones to demonstrate that you have a platform. So what does it take to build a platform? And this was interesting as I got to know Flagship and got on the CDA. And I remember visiting Ampersand, talking to some of the scientists. And it was really great, very exciting. And then that night, one of the Flagship recruitment team members called me and said, hey, Jason, could you come in to Flagship tomorrow? We'd like to give a presentation on your vision for the company. We'll talk about platform building approach with partnership.
And then?
So in the CEO world, you have to be ready to hustle.
Yeah,
and respond and react. So we had that conversation. I remember talking about and Flagship, the Flagship partnership, one of the ultimate platform building company groups.
Mm-hmm.
So showing that you have a platform that you can do this multiple times,
right?
That you can do it on demand, right? And you really can do something that's not been done before, right?
Yeah,
right. And then if you really, so that's principle one, right? Are you building a platform company? Show that you can do it multiple times. From a preclinical perspective, do you have this right data set? Then you can pick projects that can become your portfolio. You can pick projects that you can partner, right, with potential pharma companies as well. But if you really take the time and the emphasis and the investment into knowing that you've got a platform and you're recruiting people who want to build platform companies, versus just saying, yeah, of course we want to get to the clinic. Yes, of course we want to win medicines. But spending the time to ensure that that mindset and that culture is built in.
Yeah.
Starts to come out and it's incredibly important. So it's not just from an investor perspective, it's also from a team.
Yeah. Yeah. When you stepped into the role at Ampersand, what 5 months ago, you're well aware of the environment, right? The financial environment when you take that position. How did you personally rationalize that? Like,
yes,
stepping into a startup,
yes,
in a pretty rocky time.
Yeah, so the capital markets have been turbulent, as you're alluding to, for some time, both in the private as well as public markets and sector, macro forces and some sector-specific forces. And having learned a lot from the Magenta experience as a private company CEO and a public company CEO, it was very helpful for me to rationalize that. But in my opinion, at the time, my view was that type of turbulence actually selects for the best science. Mm-hmm. It selects for the best opportunities and the best teams,
right?
And so I found it relatively, in my opinion, straightforward to filter and think about that. And so when I got to know Flagship and Ampersand, it was a blow away, like amazing opportunity. The world around became very still. And I think Yuval refers to it as the poly crisis, right? That drives innovation. It drives opportunity. And for me, it was actually relatively straightforward. Seeing the science and those, principles I talked about, the opportunity for patients and the team.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about, the team, the science. Those were probably the first and easiest boxes to check.
Yes.
The patient impact. I want to have a conversation around the platform.
Yep.
So dig into the platform and then sort of translate that to it's a few clicks away, but the intended patient impact. You talked briefly about the address, navigate, determine, and trademarked and platform. Give us a little more color on that.
Yes. Yeah. So basically, the three pillars to platform the address map first, right? So that's that big data set that we're constantly curating, constantly updating and increasing. So we have lots of data, over a terabyte in data, which is where over 100 billion data points across disease, across different OX, across different proteins, and so mapping tissues and cells that are exquisite well, together with an algorithm you can use to predict addresses, has constantly been updated, and a team of computational biologists and a team of scientists who work very closely within the flagship Pioneer intelligence team and the cloud system. So a lot of really heavy duty data and scientists. So then the second pillar is the navigator, so building these molecules in silico, which I think has really been a massive step forward for the industry over the last several years. And the ability to do that and to convert basically what would have taken years into months to design molecules and fine tune them, right? So in our case, we've got antibodies, so like an antibody targeting piece and an active drug. And we can fine tune both of those in silico. So we can take an approved drug and make it better, not just by targeting it to the right place, but by optimizing its properties. Yeah, good. So you can do that. And then the determine piece, which is when we make a couple of few of these molecules, we can test them in the lab. So we have lab-based scientists who run these studies. And then the data that come out of these studies very quickly feed back into the platform through machine learning. And the platform becomes even more powerful and more accurate.
Yeah.
So that's a trick. It's just, now, we also last week announced we acquired an antibody discovery platform company in Europe. Yeah. So AbCheck. Yeah, that's right. So the reason we did that was because we were starting to see that science emerged from the Empson platform, and we knew that we would need to make antibody binding
markers, antibodies.
And AbCheck had the experience, the capabilities to be able to do that with full stack discovery technologies in the lab, including cutting edge technologies like microfluidics and functional antibody screening. So you can go end to end to generate clinical grade antibodies. They have a huge amount of experience. So on day one, we became an integrated antibody discovery company. We can now take a really cool platform, early science, and start to make medicines and then to the clinic. Very different. So we basically not only doubled the size of the company, but became a different company because of that and really accelerated the development. So it's somewhat unusual for a startup company to be acquiring a platform company.
Right.
Often happens the other way around.
Right.
And I give a lot of credit to, you know, Flagship and the Ampersand leadership together going through that. There's a team.
No.
And it's going to be exciting moving forward this year.
Yeah, actually. A bunch of follow-up questions there, but I want to start with one of the boxes that you had to check, and that was the people.
Yes.
And in a company such as you're describing, it's a common refrain that, you know, the marriage, and I see it getting better. I want your perspective on it. The marriage of computational biology and computational anything, right?
Like yes.
the tech folks and
yes.
and the science folks.
Yes.
It's a difficult one to officiate, right? So I've heard multiple approaches. I've talked to biotech CEOs who are in this space and in the AI space who've talked about, you know, throwing them in a room together, making sure they're in close proximity and they start speaking the same language as a starting point. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Like, how are you making sure that box, those people
yes.
are the rare breed that
yes.
can walk both sides of that line, right? Or yes. at least work together on other sides.
Yes. Yeah. So we start with the principle. So we are one company, right? I've been understanding, share vision, style rates, and so on. And so, you know, having our team on site, we now have two sites, right? But certainly together in the same room, talking about the science, but also it works both ways, this communication dialogue. So it's also about the computational biology team sharing what they're doing and our lab-based scientists sharing what they're doing and listening to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Those two different silos. But I think you're right in terms of alluding to the different backgrounds and potentially different cultures. If you're in front of the computer doing all your work on the computer every day, yeah, if you're you're a scientist in the lab, the bench, it's almost two different matters.
Right.
And I think it's part of my job, part of the leadership team's job, to make sure that we are able to communicate within the company as well and share about knowledge and share about culture together. It's a constant, I think, another thing you have to put it on the table and say, look, this could be a challenge. Right? So let's A, recognize that, B, think about how we continue to communicate transparently and share information.
Yeah. When you look at the talent pool that's available to you to serve those needs, are you seeing change there in terms of like what academia is putting out? People who are well versed in both languages, understanding the value of computation and all, coming out of the science side and vice versa. Like when the concept began, there really wasn't, I'm assuming, in academia, an academic path toward being a computational biologist.
Yes. So I think what we're seeing now, my sense, strong sense, is we're actually seeing folks on the biologist side moving into their second or third roles in industry.
Yeah.
So we're seeing people join earlier stage companies, bringing more experience now from within industry, together with the academic track as well, but we can roles. And so I think there's a very interesting maturation of the talent pool happening right now very quickly. And I think some of that is being accelerated as well by a number of the sort of company turnovers and changes that we've seen in the sector over the last year. So that's also happening in the biology side as well.
And then
I think that's helping, right? In terms of how we recruit and think about talent development.
Yeah. Another common refrain around AI and ML is that, like, there are obvious benefits and applications happening in terms of speed of discovery and speed of design efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
But a question that comes up often in my conversation is what the next application for these technologies is when you enter the clinic, like, because that's where the expenses mount. That's where, that's where failure happens quickly. Sometimes not so quickly. Failure happens after a lot of money's invested. Do you have any thoughts on that? Like where a company like Ampersand, as it continues out sort of the clinical continuum, where it might be able to leverage some of these technologies to improve efficiencies beyond discovery and design?
Yeah. So, I think there's a couple of areas. It's a great question, and I do think it's a very important question for us as an industry. Going back to that 90% failure rate number.
Right? Yeah.
So how do we take clinical data and early translational medicine data and feedback into our use of data? It's almost like a continuum of our lab-based data. How can we learn quickly from our medicines early in the clinic versus late in development?
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually see a natural opportunity to start client and start our tech platform and understand our machine learning with more molecules in the clinic. And we definitely intend to do that. I mean, I know it's within the flagship ecosystem that pioneering intelligence, which is like a central AI machine learning team. Within flagship and across flagship, that is a huge area. The announcement this week with the Samsung partnership flagship, there's some of that element within that partnership and clinical trial centers.
Yeah. Can you share anything in terms of like what a pipeline development plan might look like?
Right. Yeah. So that is very exciting. So as I mentioned, building out a platform first and only out of the fiber platform.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have projects that Ampersand ongoing. We have around a dozen active projects right now across different diseases. What I will tell you, first of all, is all of those projects have big impact founding propositions clinically. So we've really directed the platform early on. Hard problems. Not easy, small step changes, modified molecule safety, but can we improve both potency and safety at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
molecules that have failed, right? Or molecules that aren't new drugs that are not being used in a broader patient population as possible. So I will say at this point, we are seeing some really nice data in autoimmune diseases, immuno-oncology. Can we target tumors more effectively? Avoiding side effects is some very powerful mechanisms. So we're seeing some very nice data there. So we'll talk more about the portfolio as it evolves, but we think about it from our own core portfolio, and then also what we do with partnerships. There are certain areas, disease areas, where it would be incredibly synergistic to apply the Ampersand platform and for Ampersand to develop into those areas with a partner that brings that expertise, potentially brings drugs that they want to optimize and send to the right place. So it'd be just natural areas of overlapping interest. We're already having some partnership discussions deployed during this week at JP Morgan.
Yeah,
that's part of our vision. Meeting next, so it seems a lot more to come on.
A platform company has all sorts of optionality in terms of partnerships, exits, mergers. You know, optionality is like the name of the game. Do you run sort of as you know? Obviously, you're in early, but looking forward, are you running kind of fast and loose and looking for opportunities like wherever they might present themselves, or do you have some sort of an idea like, you know, this is a platform that we could outsource, or this is a platform that we could handily stick around forever, spinning off products that we then sell? Or is it, you know, opportunity presents itself when you realize it, when you see it?
Yeah. So we spend a lot of time thinking about partnerships,
mm-hmm.
and initial partnerships, early partnerships for a platform company are very important. First of all, because they have the opportunity to validate
the what?
And then second is to build out projects, programs that potentially wouldn't do. They're our capitalist company. So we spent a lot of time planning through scenarios, how they could look, so that we are, I would say, ready and prepared for opportunities, right? Versus being loose and unprepared.
I say fast. I should have known the response I was going to get to that.
But it's you know, but maximizing optionality is important. I would say there's no type of partnership, there's no type of deal structure or therapeutic area that we would not consider, because the platform's so broad that percent. The question is really, in terms of quantity and quality, what we decide to do internally, and that makes sense.
All indicators, not all indicators, but many indicators are kind of pointing to a return of the markets, right? Like things are starting to look better. In a situation like yours, when you're, you know, looking for and open to early deals, early platform deals, is there a more ideal sort of market condition for that kind of thing and a less ideal market condition? Like, would it be a scenario where you might go, you know what, like we're ready, but we could probably strike some better deals if it's 6 months from now, and some of these indicators like inflation and the merger M&A markets continue to look good and deals are looking better, we're gonna kind of hold our cards here a bit,
right?
Is that a fair question to ask?
Well, I think it's important. I mean, I think that I look at it a different way, Matt, which is, you know, what do you control and what do you not control? So. Well, we don't control the macro forces, things that are in the market. Inflation is not what we do control, that percent. So you can think about these potential partnerships since when and how and how they approach. So that's why I think it's important. But I would like to take a step back because as we think about this platform, you must be following, have seen the explosion of antibody drug conjugate
mm-hmm.
partnerships, approvals, M&A, acquisition. Antibody drug conjugates are really the core, the starting point of what we do at Ampersand, except we're not just working in tumors using three classes of payloads, toxic payloads, and 11 tumor targets.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually able to deliver different types of molecules, active drugs to multiple tissues, right? So this is like the next generation of antibody drug conjugates. So this whole concept of targeting drugs to the right places where they need it, we see ADC as being a proof principle of that,
mm-hmm.
but in a very small target space, that and targets. So we have close to 700 talks across different tissues.
Yeah.
Would that be drug as well? So when you think about, you know, the weight of interest in ADCs, the types of market conditions, I find that very interesting from a micro sector perspective within biotech.
Mm-hmm.
That obviously is very different from the macro forces. I think we could talk about IRA, Russia, carbon cliffs, and so on in the industry at writ large, and how innovation, true, you know, high quality science and like patient impact with platform companies are incredibly powerful.
Yeah. What's the next big step for Ampersand? Yeah, like, what's your, you know, obviously, yeah, you're here. That's a big step in a busy week. When you get back to your day to day, like, what's the next
thing? So this year is going to be exciting. We're going to see more science emerge from the platform, selecting our first set of lead projects to move forward to development candidates.
Mm-hmm.
As a concrete big milestone. And then executing on partnerships. We have a lot to do this year. We just acquired a company. Obviously, did that last week. So building out the antibody discovery capabilities and lots of execution. We are in discussions with both partners and investors about the next chapter. It's all built on science and the story and the value proposition. There's a lot going on. It's great.
Yeah, it is a lot. Your plate is full. Another question about that acquisition. Whenever you acquire a company, obviously it's disruptive. It's good. Obviously, I mean, there's value, but it's also disruptive. To the mission you were on prior to the acquisition. So give us some color on how you're sort of managing through the integration of this company.
Yeah.
Maybe even some illustration of what that integration is going to look like in terms of, like, you know, physical space and technology and people.
Sure. So we had a head start with Amcheck because we had already been working with them. Everybody had the story campaigns. So we had that relationship last year. And then we were already planning for success. So we've already been planning through the integration together. So both groups working together, especially about, you know, decision-making, communication. So they're based in the Czech Republic.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously time zone difference. We are used to working across time zones, but working by video, conferences. But, you know, really playing that forward and overly communicating. And so starting to lay out objectives and plans. And it's actually, you know, it's early days. Going well so far, but planning for, you know, what could go wrong before it happens, and then being able to communicate that, I think, is incredibly important from a culture perspective.
You know,
and so that's something that we're working on together.
Yeah,
preparing for this year and beyond. And also, I will add that within the flagship ecosystem, that capability is also very powerful, being able to generate our own antibodies, not just at Ampersand, but all together with other flagship companies as well. I'm going to see this platform really accelerate next year or two.
Outstanding. What haven't I covered? Like, what if I were a better interviewer, what should I have answered you that I didn't?
I think we covered the full landscape here.
Yeah, we covered a lot of ground.
No, sure.
You either have something great or you're waiting whether
that I get asked a lot is what keeps you awake at night?
It's a good question.
Yeah, it's always a combination of data and people.
Data and people keep you up at night?
It's always constantly. Yeah. You're thinking about what will the days look like? How do we recruit for the best talent, right? How do we compete? How do you build a company? The combination of that is any co-caring CEO is thinking about that.
Yeah.
And they're not going to tell you that.
When you say data, the data that keeps you there, like, be more specific.
Oh, about data, what's the next data set look like? Are we on track? Right.
Yeah. Not the machine learning, not the data sets that you're using in the applications.
So the data sets for machine learning, actually, when we see the data in the lab on these molecules that come out of the Ampersand platform, we almost cannot lose, because on the one hand, the data from the lab experiments could be positive, right? And the molecules work. They're being designed. That's cool. That's great. Great for the platform. Great for the venture partner. If they don't work, it's obviously hugely valuable because that's it's a platform. And the machine like they use this training data set, they're like gold.
Yeah.
Both positive and negative. So as a machine learning platform, your platform gets stronger both on positive and negative data. Mm-hmm. Because all the experiments have been run right with the right controls.
Yeah. That negative data, the failure data, the stuff that doesn't work, is that largely proprietary? I was just having a conversation.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Purposefully?
Yeah. Yeah. We actually like to make a couple molecules that we think are not going to work as well to test the negative and all hypothesis.
Yeah.
Other than just having a no treatment, if you like, control, we have to make a molecule that is designed not to work as well.
Yeah, been trying to. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I was talking to someone earlier today who was talking about a panel presentation here at this event that addressed that issue. That, you know, in the public domain, there's plenty of success data, right?
Yes.
To pull from, but there's very little in the way of, you know, deep failure data. And that was acknowledged as a problem as AI and ML become more pervasive in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I agree. I think the underreporting and negative data has been with us as an industry for a long time. I think from a culture perspective, in terms of building a company, recognizing the importance of getting to no-go decision points through negative data is really hard.
Yeah.
I think the best companies are able to recognize and celebrate that and understand how that can be a high quality and very impactful piece. But now, you know, just to go back to the platform, machine learning is incredibly important to have high quality data sets feeding back in and then know how it goes with that.
Mm-hmm. You framed that question that I should have asked as what keeps me up at night, which, you know, has sort of a negative intonation, like a concerned intonation. Are the things that keep you up at night in a concerned way the same things that excite you?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, I think, so just to go back to this piece of, you know, living with ambiguity and optionality can actually drive, I think, great innovation companies. Finding solutions quickly. And Flagship, this is called paranoid optimism.
I've heard the term.
Right. So it exists on a daily basis, packaging the CEO world. And it comes to that point here. I was just mentioning it. You have to be able to, I remember mentors over the years telling me, spend time predicting the future. Because if you're not, as a CEO, nobody else can do that. Effectively, and trying to do that and also being paranoid and both optimistic in the role is very challenging, super exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes we get exciting data and positive data where we least expect it, and the opposite can be true as well.
Yeah,
in the industry, but early discovery platform companies at this time, and I think within the Flagship ecosystem is a great place to be.
Yeah, that's terrific. All right, so personal question, because paranoia and optimism can both be unhealthy if taken in too large a dose. What do you do to, personally, like what do you do to decompress, to make sure that you're not taking your paranoia and your hype home with you and to keep your you know, your sanity?
Yeah, simple. Turn off my phone and be my family.
Yeah.
Start there. Everything else is straightforward.
Very good. Yeah. Well, I appreciate the time. This has been very insightful, and I enjoyed meeting with you. I thank you for spending. I know there's a lot of demand for your time, so I'm honored that you spent some of it.
Oh, pleasure, Matt.
Yeah,
really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Good to meet you.
Thanks.
I'm Matt Piller, and you just listened to The Business of Biotech, the weekly podcast dedicated to the builders of biotech. We drop a new episode with a new exec every Monday morning. And I'd like you to join our community of subscribers at bioprocessonline.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our never spammy, always insightful monthly newsletter at bioprocessonline.com/BOB. If you have feedback or topic and guest suggestions, hit me up on LinkedIn and let's chat. And as always, thanks for listening.